as Story Publishing presents The Price of Alignment. Dawn leaks through the slats of the 11th floor boardroom, painting the conference table a hopeful amber. Outside, the city is still yawning awake. Inside, the chairs already hold a full cast of characters. At the head sits Marisol Herrera, founder and majority shareholder of Verde Organics, a rapidly scaling food tech darling. Along the flanks, her newly hired chief executive, a celebrated turnaround artist, two vice presidents eager for upward thrust, and a trio of restless investors who arrived on the red eye. Cups hiss, screens flicker, and agendas clatter onto the polished wood. A casual observer might assume everyone in this room wants the same thing, Verde's enduring success. Yet before the first slide appears, subtle fault lines form. Marisol's eyes search for bold 5-year expansion plans. The CEO quietly wonders how to contain risk long enough to earn his performance award. The investors crave near-term multiples that let them rotate into the next hot deal. Welcome to the most pervasive riddle in corporate life. Why do owners and managers, ostensibly united by a common enterprise, so often desire different outcomes? The economist's answer carries a deceptively plain label: the principal-agent problem. But its implications animate every chapter of modern finance. Principals are the owners who supply capital and bear the ultimate uncertainty of enterprise. Agents are the people hired to run the show. Because ownership is diffuse, observation imperfect, and human motives gloriously varied, agents may steer the ship off the shareholder course, sometimes by inches, occasionally by miles. The wedge between what principals want and what agents do is measured in dollars. Those dollars carry their own name, agency costs. Think of agency costs as a 3-layered toll: monitoring expenses, bonding commitments, and the residual loss that remains even after all the oversight. Monitoring includes audit firms combing through ledgers, independent directors scrutinizing strategy, and investor relations staff packaging quarterly narratives. Bonding involves employment contracts that promise golden handshakes, stock options that aim to weld fortunes together, and covenants that limit how much mischief can be funded with borrowed cash. Residual loss is the wealth that would have existed had incentives aligned perfectly but slipped away instead. Every time a manager chooses a private jet over a commercial flight or avoids a risky but value-positive project, that gap quietly widens. The abstract becomes vivid when we look around. One once-storied conglomerate spent $6 billion on a pair of Gulfstream G650s, each outfitted with marble-rimmed lavatories, all in the name of facilitating global synergies. Shareholders footed the bill. Executives enjoyed the leather. An activist investor eventually exposed the jet's annual burn, but the money was already gone and the marble installed. A more famous example is WeWork, where Adam Neumann leased buildings in his own name, only to sublease them at a profit. Board seats and prospectus documents were in place, yet his control over information outpaced every safeguard until the IPO imploded and billions evaporated. Or consider the regional bank that rewarded branch managers on net new accounts. Faced with stringent targets, employees created phantom customers, triggering regulatory onslaughts, shattered reputation, and costly compensation overhauls. Still, good governance can narrow the principal-agent gap. In the 1980s, Nucor Steel adopted transparent bonus systems tied to productivity metrics available to every employee. When mini mills across the Rust Belt floundered, Nucor thrived, demonstrating that smart incentives can unite managers and owners. Yet perfect alignment is an illusion. Tying bonuses too tightly to stock price may trigger short-term earnings gains at the expense of research. Loosen the leash, and you risk empire-building mergers that dilute returns for years. The dance between oversight and autonomy never ends. It merely shifts rhythm. Now picture yourself as the new chief financial officer asked to trim head office spending by 10% without stalling growth. Before you sharpen the scalpel, ask what numbers reveal genuine waste versus quiet investments that safeguard revenue, whose dashboards will blink if corporate travel budgets shrink, and how your own success will be measured: immediate savings or long-term value added. Each choice, whether incremental audits, revised bonus grids, or a broader cultural shift, carries its own price in monitoring and bonding costs, plus the lurking possibility of residual loss. Even the best-intentioned remedy can open new avenues of misalignment if used clumsily. In the chapters ahead, we will explore frameworks to diagnose and manage these trade-offs. Clearer definitions of economic profit, sharper discount rates, smarter scorecards, and capital structures that clarify rather than obscure. But all roads lead back to this dawn-lit boardroom and the gulf it reveals. Owners and managers rarely wake up wanting exactly the same thing. Agency costs track the consequences. Your task, as analyst, executive, or enterprising shareholder, is to narrow the gap until value flows where it was meant to go. So take a deep breath, straighten your virtual tie, and picture that 11th floor view. The sun is higher now, spilling across spreadsheets and strategy decks. Somewhere among the ledger lines and the human ambitions encoded within them lies the art of alignment. Let's step closer and learn to read it. Morning has fully broken. Elevators whir, phones trill, and the day's first metrics flash across the executive dashboard. You, newly attuned to the perils of misalignment, have glimpsed how agents can steer off course when owners' expectations diverge from managerial goals. Yet identifying the drift is just the start. Harnessing a reliable measure of value, one managers cannot manipulate with cosmetic tweaks, offers the real cure. For most of the 20th century, that yardstick was accounting profit. Today, it yields to a sturdier lens. Picture the same visionary company from the early boardroom scene, Verde Organics, announcing a radiant headline, "Net income rises by 25%. Celebration rings hollow when a curious board member inquires, "And how much capital did we tie up to get there?" In standard accounting, equity is treated as a gift from the cosmos. Interest on debt appears plainly, but the cost of shareholders' capital hides in silence. That hush nudges managers toward any project that earns above zero, ignoring the reality that investors might command higher returns elsewhere for similar risk. Economic income, often called residual income, corrects this omission by levying a capital charge. It starts with net operating profit after taxes, NOPAT, then subtracts a cost for using other people's money. The result, known by the trademark name EVA, is the true surplus or deficit created for owners after every explicit and implicit invoice is paid. When Stern Stewart popularized EVA in the 1990s, the trademark was less important than the insight. Capital is never free. Walk through an example. Suppose Verde reports $75 million of NOPAT and sits on $600 million of invested capital. Its debt costs 7%, its equity nearer 12%, blending to a 9% weighted average cost of capital. Multiply 9% by $600 million and you get $54 million. When you subtract that capital charge from $75 million, Verde's real contribution to owner wealth stands at $21 million of EVA. If the board hears about a new project that promises an extra $10 million in profits, but demands $200 million in fresh capital, the same 9% rule reveals a charge of $18 million, leaving an $8 million shortfall despite the flattering boost to reported earnings. Concrete numbers help EVA come to life. You begin with revenue and subtract operating costs to reach EBIT. From there, strip out tax at the statutory rate, say 25%, to capture the true after-tax operating profit called NOPAT. Then introduce the line capital charge, computed as the weighted average cost times invested capital. Finally, subtract that from NOPAT to arrive at EVA, a single figure that checks whether the firm earned enough to compensate not only lenders but shareholders. This approach can galvanize change. In the late 1990s, major industrial players found that once they charged business units for devouring balance sheet space, managers rushed to free up cash and whittle down inventories. The logic is simple. Tax something, and people use less of it. Apply a charge to capital, and departments stop hoarding it. Alongside these positives, however, lurk hazards. If assets are grossly undervalued on the books, inflation might mask a capital base that deserves a higher charge. If the same corporate cost of capital is applied to every division, low-risk operations can wind up cross-subsidizing higher-risk units. Thus, EVA is only as accurate as the data powering it. A brief mental exercise cements the method. Suppose a consumer electronics maker has EBIT of $240 million, a tax rate of 28%, and $1.8 billion in invested capital, all financed at a 10% blended rate. SPECNOPAT becomes $173 million after taxes, while the capital charge stands at $180 million. Subtracting one from the other reveals a negative $7 million EVA, an unpleasant surprise for anyone eyeing only the $173 million post-tax figure. Where accounting profit flatters, EVA insists on accountability. It asks whether each asset or expansion is worth the risk to shareholders whose funds are at stake. Instead of celebrating growth for growth's sake, boards can glance at the revitalized ledger and see whether new ventures truly lift the owner's wealth. Properly handled, this measure forces tough questions and tilts decisions toward generating real returns rather than surface-level gains. Keep that principle in mind as the day gathers pace. Soon enough, we must pinpoint what that full cost of capital really is, since a flawed rate can distort even the most elegant measure. For now, take comfort in having an instrument that stands guard at the gates of good judgment. A single extra line in the financial statement can shift corporate behavior in ways that quarterly earnings alone could never accomplish. The lunch crowd has just begun to drift back toward Verdi's headquarters when you, freshly armed with your newly honed appreciation for EVA, enter the glass-walled Capital Allocation Committee room. Every quarter, the air seems to warm as the decisions made here determine which pet projects get money and which go unfunded. On the wall, a single slide in forest green letters reads WACC, a small acronym that stands for the heartbeat of value. Each pulse reveals how much the outside world charges Verdi to rent its money. When that heartbeat races too fast, good opportunities shrivel, too slow, and resources flood into ventures that can't repay their real owners. Begin with the arteries feeding that pulse. Debt is the obvious vessel. Lenders charge interest, and the government lowers the after-tax cost by allowing interest deductions. If Verdi floats 10-year notes at 8% in a 25% tax bracket, its effective debt cost slips to 6%. Equity, meanwhile, comes with no such shield. Investors demand a return that compensates them for volatility, making equity more expensive. A diversified market might yield 10% overall. Risk-free treasuries sit at 3, and Verdi's beta stands at 1.2. Multiply that 1.2 by the 7-point gap between market and treasuries, and you add 8.4% to the risk-free rate, landing at 11.4 for equity. Blend this with the cheaper after-tax debt in a 40-60 mix, and you get a 9.4% WACC, a single number the committee has long applied to every project, from expanding almond butter lines in California to launching kombucha subscriptions in Tokyo. Today, though, two proposals challenge that habit. One is a rooftop greenhouse that promises steady, utility-like cash flows. The other is an AI-driven farm-to-avatar experiment selling digital produce skins for gaming environments. Both claim internal rates of return above 10%, so under the one-size-fits-all 9.4% hurdle, the verdict would be a green light for both. Enter senior analyst Priya Deshmukh, who reworks the math with risk-calibrated rates. She argues the stable greenhouse initiative, buffered by long-term contracts, deserves a lower bar around 7%, while the metaverse platform, wilder and more volatile, sits closer to 15%. When she revalues the AI project with that higher discount, a net present value that looked robust at 9.4 collapses into a marginal scrap of upside at best. The room hushes. This is the single rate fallacy exposed. Using one corporate hurdle for both a low-risk core and a speculative moonshot can destroy wealth by admitting poor projects or by rejecting prudent ones. She walks the committee through the numbers. Discounting the AI venture's projected cash flows at 9.4 yields a tidy $11.8 million NPV, but raising the discount to 15 drops that figure to under $2 million, easily erased by a small slip in revenue assumptions. Why has Verdi clung to a corporate rate if it risks such misallocation? Because it's convenient, and because bonuses hinge on EBIT growth. The rooftop greenhouse modestly boosts earnings, while the metaverse bet could explode the top line. That skew tilts the same incentive system toward the riskier gamble, and a single whack quietly greases the path. Priya's work forces a reckoning. If the board embraces divisional hurdle rates, managers pitching speculative ideas must clear a taller bar to get funded, with rewards that match the added strain. picture yourself as the head of digital strategy, set to pocket a percentage of any jump in EBIT surpassing last year's base. At the old 9.4 rate, your project promised a soaring top line and a handsome personal return. Under the new lens, you might never launch. Do you challenge her assumptions, lobby to keep the universal rate, or insist that strategic optionality justifies a discount? Such battles often hinge on how firmly compensation is anchored to real economic value rather than raw operating profit. The chief risk officer, Matteo, proposes that any division with cash flow volatility far from the core must develop its own WACC, subject to Treasury's review of peer group betas, regression of divisional profitability, and independent debt capacity estimates. Some groan at the extra spreadsheets, but Verde's founder nods at the necessity. Even the calculations for each division follow the same recipe as the corporate WACC, just with different ingredients. A greenhouse project might safely assume half its funding via debt at 5% after tax and a beta of 0.6, leading to a total rate near 6. The metaverse unit can barely rely on debt at all and brandishes a beta of 2, driving a WACC that pushes 17. That stark gap does more than shift numbers, it influences behavior. With a fairer capital charge, the greenhouse division invests in stable gains, while the digital arm must aim exceptionally high or step aside altogether. As daylight fades, the committee approves 3 changes. Verde will keep a publicly disclosed corporate WACC for investor relations, but also adopt specific divisional rates for internal project appraisal. Performance bonuses above a certain level will move from EBIT to EVA, factoring in each division's risk-based capital charge. Any unit angling for a lower hurdle must prove how it furthers genuine shareholder value rather than individual pocketbooks. No fireworks follow the vote. Only the quiet shuffle of chairs and the faint hum of managers recalculating NPVs in their heads. Stepping into the hallway, you sense a deep shift. Tomorrow's pitches will begin with risk rather than just flashy headlines, and managers once obsessed with scale will chase economic surplus instead. Before turning the page, carry forward 3 mental touchstones. WACC is neither a ceiling to be bargained down nor a floor to be casually tripped over. It's the market's best guess of what investors would earn elsewhere for similar risks. The tax shield on debt is real, but never truly free. It comes attached to an obligation to pay interest through thick and thin. And an untethered discount rate can sabotage long-term wealth by seducing managers with near-term illusions. Our next step will delve into shaping compensation so no single year's payoff tempts a team to sow the seeds of a future write-off. For now, linger on the arithmetic that saved Verde from an overhyped adventure and steered capital toward gardens that will one day bear fruit. Late afternoon sunlight slants through the same glass walls that hosted the morning's capital allocation drama. Now the Compensation and Talent Committee, smaller, quieter, yet no less consequential, assembles to decide how Verde's 600 leaders will be paid next year. Numbers, not Novembers, trigger harvests in most corporations, and the seeds sown here will blossom or rot throughout the organization. At one end of the table, Chief People Officer Camila Shaw unfurls a slide labeled Performance Scorecard 2024. It glows with familiar comforts, earnings per share growth, revenue targets, and a stylish metric called ROIS Lite that strips out non-core assets to make returns look sleeker. Across from her sits Matteo, the risk officer, still mindful of that morning's lessons about discount rates. He asks a simple question. If freight costs spike or a drought hits our Chilean avocado orchards, who on this list can actually influence the outcome? Silence follows. Controllability, the soul of a fair metric, is about to take center stage. Why does controllability matter so much? Because people lean toward whatever moves the dial on their pay. Give a plant manager a quarterly return on assets hurdle, and the easiest path is to shrink the denominator. Cancel maintenance, delay safety upgrades, run equipment hotter and faster. For 3 quarters, the ROA climbs, bonuses clear, and everyone applauds operational genius. By the 4th, a conveyor belt snaps, halting production for weeks and vaporizing the saved dollars tenfold. The same arithmetic drives regional sales heads measured on gross revenue. Discount product heavily, ship to intermediaries who stuff warehouses, watch the top line pop. and pray no one notices the returns that flood back next quarter. A decade ago, an iconic apparel chain chased EBITDA per square foot so zealously that store managers walled off changing rooms to squeeze in extra racks. Sales rose, customer satisfaction plunged, social media erupted, and the metric was quietly retired. More recent headlines come from a streaming service that tied executive bonuses to subscriber growth at any cost. Free trial farms sprouted overnight, inflating new accounts while churn galloped unseen. When the service finally switched to a retention-weighted metric, the growth veneer cracked, and the stock lost a third of its value in 2 days. The point is not that metrics are malign, it is that they are magnetic. They pull behavior toward themselves with invisible force. The wrong metric wields that magnetism like a compass set to the wrong pole. Camila advances to a heat map showing each executive's line of sight to the proposed scorecard. Supply chain chief Ricardo can sway inventory turns but not foreign exchange swings in EPS. The head of digital strategy can influence app engagement, yet her fate hinges on consolidated ROI, a ratio poisoned by legacy assets she neither uses nor controls. Why, Mateo wonders aloud, should digital's bonus swing on whether a 3-decade-old almond butter plant depreciates faster or slower than planned? Controllability has 2 layers. First, managers must influence the outcome. Second, they must feel that influence. A shipping delay they truly could have prevented counts as fair pressure. A drought, a tariff decree, or a global pandemic does not. Miss that distinction, and you breed cynicism, the fertilizer of agency costs. The committee turns to EVA, the hero of earlier chapters. It scores high on economic truth, but can falter on controllability if deployed crudely. Consider Verde's R&D lab, where scientists test grain-free fermentation. Their experiments spend cash now and maybe someday create margins that justify the cost. If EVA is calculated annually with no adjustment, the lab bleeds red ink for years, and the chief scientist becomes the corporate villain. Strip R&D from the formula entirely and the courage to invest returns, but so does the temptation to pursue science projects with no commercial end. Many firms adopt a middle path called a capital charge holiday. Expenses to discover next-generation products are capitalized and exempt from the charge for 3 or 4 years, giving the team a window to prove value before the meter starts running. Behaviors shift in an instant. Researchers chase breakthroughs with genuine commercial potential rather than lodge comfortably in curiosity corner. After an hour of spirited debate, Camila dims the projector and introduces 3 realigned metrics to test against Verde's evolving needs. First, a multi-year EVA trend replaces 1-year EPS. Instead of celebrating a sugar rush in 2024, leaders will be judged on whether EVA 3 years hence beats a rolling baseline. The longer horizon dulls the impulse to gut marketing in Q4 just to lift end-year profit. It also means investments that gestate slowly, rooftop greenhouses, fermentation platforms, even that cautiously screened metaverse idea, have time to bear fruit before payoffs are tallied. Second, asset turns and maintenance quality sit alongside return on capital for plant managers. A hidden sensor network will feed a dashboard that flags deferred upkeep, preventing the old run-it-into-the-ground trick. The maintenance metric is fully controllable, and by pairing it with asset turns, the company signals that caring for the denominator matters as much as milking the numerator. Third, divisional chiefs adopt a risk-adjusted growth index. Here, the G in growth is weighted by the spread between their project returns and their bespoke WAC. A low-risk greenhouse expansion that earns 10% above its 6% hurdle scores higher than a moonshot earning 16 against 15. Growth alone no longer dazzles. Growth that crests above risk does. By design, chiefs cannot game the denominator because Treasury owns the hurdle rate. To keep the system transparent, Verde moves from annual bonus cliff edges to a sliding scale. Miss the target by a hair and you still earn partial credit. Exceed it, and rewards step up progressively rather than in abrupt windfalls that tempt number shading in December. What about factors outside anyone's control? Currency shocks, geopolitical tariffs, those ride in a context factor. A discretionary dial, the board can twist by plus or minus 10% when events clearly overwhelm managerial influence. The knob is tiny on purpose, big enough to correct obvious injustice, too small to invite constant lobbying. The committee pauses for coffee, and your narrator invites you to sketch your own redesign. Picture a business unit making eco-friendly packaging film. Choose 3 or 4 measures to steer its leader. Maybe EVA growth net of commodity price swings, a customer-weighted satisfaction metric to dissuade value-destroying cost cuts, and a pipeline index that ensures fresh patents keep rolling. Decide how you'd weight them, how long the measurement window should run, and which elements you'd exclude because they drift beyond managerial reach. If you need inspiration, glance at the missteps just recounted. Each was born from a metric tuned to the wrong frequency. As the evening sun disappears behind the skyline, the committee votes. Verdi's scorecard will shift to multi-year EVA, maintenance-weighted asset returns, and risk-adjusted growth. Capital charge holidays will shelter early R&D, and a narrow context factor will buffer uncontrollable shocks. No metric is perfect, but this blend squares 4 powerful circles: economic accuracy, behavioral clarity, risk sensitivity, and most crucial, controllability. Camila sends the last slide flickering off the wall. The room exhales. Down on the production floor, no one yet knows their incentives just changed. But soon a maintenance supervisor will realize that skipping a bearing replacement no longer juices her ROA. A digital product manager will see that inflating app downloads without profitable retention now hurts her risk-adjusted spread. And somewhere, an R&D chemist will smile. The timer on her new bioresin experiment just reset to give discovery its due breathing space. Twilight deepens, lights dim, and elevators sigh as the building empties. You linger a moment, turning it all over in your mind. Tomorrow, when the first status emails fly and dashboards update, invisible magnets will already be tugging at each decision. Where to spend, what to delay, how bold to be. Metrics do indeed attract behavior, but now you know how to aim them. The next step of this journey explores how capital structure broadcasts its own incentives. For tonight, let the new scorecard settle in your thoughts and imagine the long-term value waiting to be drawn toward its pull. Dawn has given way to night again, but the glow inside Verdi's finance war room is anything but sleepy. On 3 walls, dashboards scroll the company's share price, debt maturities, and a heat map of cash balances across 27 bank accounts. In the center stands CFO Elena Duarte, sleeves rolled, voice low but urgent. Tomorrow morning, Verde will learn whether capital markets applaud or recoil from its plan to raise fresh funds. The question before her team is not simply how much money to gather, but in what form, and what hidden messages each form will broadcast. At this moment, Verde carries $400 million of long-term debt, priced at 6%, and 100 million shares trading at $20 apiece. The market therefore values the equity at $2 billion, placing total enterprise value near $2.4 billion. EBIT ran $150 million last year. Subtract 25% tax, and the company earned $112.5 million. Divide by 100 million shares, and you arrive at earnings per share of $1.13. Bonus grids for roughly 60 executives pivot on that figure. 5 cents of EPS can move year-end paychecks more than a full month's salary. Verdi's rooftop greenhouse program, greenlit after Priya's divisional WACC overhaul, requires $300 million in capital over 2 years. The payables team has modeled 3 financing routes: a seasoned equity issue, a straight debt issue, and a leveraged recapitalization, combining new debt with an aggressive share buyback. Elena wants every analyst in the room to see not only the ledger entries, but also the signals each choice sends into the market's bloodstream. First, the equity route. Suppose Verdi offers 15 million new shares at the prevailing $20 price, raising the 300 million required. Pro forma, the share count rises to 115 million. Management forecasts that once the greenhouses reach steady state, EBIT will lift by $20 million. After tax, that is $15 million of net income, taking the total to $127.5 million, divide by 115 million shares, and EPS becomes about $1.11. The project itself is strong, but immediate dilution shaves 2 cents off reported earnings per share. A manager paid on EVA might shrug. Long-run wealth rises. A manager paid on EPS feels a knife at the throat. Worse, markets often read an equity raise as a tip-off that insiders believe the stock is at best fairly priced. In the day or two following a seasoned offering, share prices typically dip 3-4%. A silent shout travels through trading floors. They sold because they could. What do they know that we don't? Leverage's first lesson emerges. Capital structure is a megaphone. Second, the pure debt path. Verde could borrow the entire $300 million at 6%, identical to its existing notes. Interest expense would jump by $18 million, trimming after-tax income by $13.5 million. The greenhouse uplift of $15 million nudges net income to $114 million. With the share count untouched at 100 million, EPS edges from $1.13 to $1.14. Accretive, yes, 1 cent better than yesterday, and executives tied to EPS raise a quiet cheer. But beneath the surface, leverage has crept up. Net debt to EBITDA nearly doubles, and analysts will worry about a possible downgrade that could lift future borrowing costs. Investors read the new obligation as a sign of confidence. Verde is willing to chain itself to fixed coupons, yet also detect the risk. If the Chilean avocado harvest fails or inflation eats margins, those coupons will not shrink in sympathy. Equity offers a cushion, debt remains a rigid promise. Finally, the bolder maneuver, a leveraged recap. Verde borrows $600 million, using half to fund the greenhouses and half to repurchase its own stock. Assume the market senses scarcity and tendered shares clear at $24, a 20% premium to yesterday's close. For $300 million, Verde buys back 12.5 million shares, shrinking the count to 87.5 million. Now tally the numbers. Interest expense soars by $36 million. After tax, the bite is $27 million. Add back the $15 million of greenhouse profit, and net income slips to $100.5 million, $11 million lower than before the transaction. But because of the slimmer share base, EPS climbs to $1.15. Absolute profit falls, earnings per share rise, and every executive with options priced at $19 suddenly looks richer. The leveraged recap is the Mona Lisa of capital structure illusions. Smile one way and see value, tilt your head and glimpse lurking danger. Elena freezes the slide. Which path creates the most wealth, she asks. A junior analyst ventures that EVA will rise most under a straightforward debt issue, given the project's positive NPV and the tax shield. A portfolio-minded treasurer cautions that higher leverage elevates the company's beta and thus the cost of equity, partly canceling that gain. The HR partner whispers that more than half of senior management's bonuses hinge on diluted EPS targets set last winter. Incentives point squarely at the leveraged recap that brightens the denominator. Now the board weighs numbers against narratives. Academic theory predicts that managers issue debt when they believe equity is undervalued and tap equity when they sense upcoming headwinds. Investors know this, so an equity deal often triggers a price dip and a buyback a pop. By simply choosing a funding route, Verde's executives will broadcast confidence or caution. That signal ricochets from Bloomberg terminals into option pricing models and back into the cost of capital. Elena then unveils a final set of forecast metrics. Under an equity issue, leverage remains tame, beta inches down to 1.15, WACC slips to 9.2%, and default risk stays at a scant 0.4%. Under the straight debt plan, beta rises to 1.25, WACC to 9.5, and default probability doubles to 0.8%, still modest, yet no longer negligible. With a leverage recap, beta spikes to 1.45, WACC to 10.1, and default risk hits 2.7%, almost 7 times the equity-funded path. Option-rich managers might applaud the EPS bump, while bondholders and risk officers quietly fret. Late into the evening, footsteps echo in empty corridors as most of the finance team disperses. Elena stays behind, scribbling on a legal pad. She drafts a plan to decouple next year's bonuses from raw EPS and anchor them instead to EVA per share, a measure that charges projects for their full cost of capital and neutralizes buyback tricks. She suggests a leverage tolerance band. Venture outside a safe zone of 2.5 to 3.0 times EBITDA and incentive payouts shrink. And for the greenhouses, she proposes a 50-50 mix, half equity, half debt. So the market sees Verde as neither starved for capital nor overextended. Whether the board adopts these guardrails will shape Verde's fortunes for a decade. Too much equity in high-return projects stall for fear of dilution. Too much debt and one supply chain hiccup invites crisis. Most perilous of all is tying managerial rewards to an accounting ratio that can be flattered by financial engineering. Capital structure decisions, Elena knows, are never just about funding, they are about storytelling. The markets read signals, and employees read their payslips. Before powering down the screens, she leaves one last note to herself. Ask Camila about option repricing under each scenario. If buybacks goose EPS, do people's shares vest too soon? And is that real value or window dressing? The question lingers like an unresolved chord. As you step back from the glowing dashboards, ask yourself which route truly maximizes shareholder wealth once tax shields, distress costs, and behavioral incentives are priced in. Which metric best keeps managers honest? Raw EPS, EVA, or free cash flow per share? And would you ever tether rewards to leverage bands, knowing full well that risk grows most elusive just when appetites run highest? The building finally goes dark, yet the signals released tomorrow will glow in capital markets. Debt or equity, buyback or issuance, each choice will shout or whisper, drawing investors closer or pushing them away. In the next part of our journey, we will watch another company navigate these waters, sometimes with grace, sometimes at painful cost, and glean the lessons. For now, hold the image of that leveraged recap that lifts EPS as profits sink, and remember, when metrics misaim, even the brightest greenhouse can cast a dangerous shadow. The winter sky above Denver is charcoal when the executive coach pulls into the Aspen Ridge Lodge, an offsite chosen to keep laptops open and cell phones muted. Orion Technologies, 50-year veteran of fiber optic hardware, 5-year aspirant to cloud analytics, has gathered its senior team for the annual Value Creation Summit. Inside the main lodge, a crackling fire competes with the glow of twin projection screens. On the left, the infrastructure division's roadmap. On the right, digital solutions sprint calendar. The symmetry is accidental. Everything else about these two businesses is not. Infrastructure, nicknamed InfraCore, sells power-conditioned routers and maintenance contracts to telecom operators from Frankfurt to Jakarta. Cash flows run steady, price competition is fierce, and the division's beta has settled at a sleepy 0.6. 2 years ago, the board approved a tailored hurdle rate, 7%, tied directly to InfraCore's risk. In parallel, it installed a bonus bank built on multi-year EVA. Carla Reyes, a 20-year Orion veteran, now leads the unit. Her dashboard tracks operating cost per installed switch, unplanned downtime, and rolling EVA. If she lifts that last figure, her payout vests. If she doesn't, it evaporates. Across the hall, Digital Solutions looks nothing like its older sibling. Think subscription APIs, AI-assisted fraud detection, an innovation cadence that runs closer to weeks than quarters. Market data place its beta near 1.7, yet the unit is still judged against Orion's all-purpose 10% WACC. Revenue growth above 20% unlocks stock option grants. EBIT above plan releases the cash bonus. Its leader, Jonah Park, ex-Silicon Valley, hoodie proudly unironed, can recite monthly active users faster than depreciation schedules. He knows his 2025 options vest at a strike price of $32. Yesterday, the stock closed at $28. Carla goes first. InfraCore needs $200 million for Project Atlas, a network backbone refresh that will shave electricity draw by one-third and cut failure tickets in half. Forecast free cash flow begins at $24 million next year, grows 2% annually, and slides gently thereafter. Discounted at her 7% hurdle, net present value lands at plus $40 million. First-year EVA, after subtracting a $14 million capital charge, clocks in at plus $6 million. Not glamorous, she concedes, but $40 million of value beats $0 million of charisma. Jonah follows with Project Nebula, a mobile payments overlay aimed at emerging market gamers. He needs $150 million. The pro forma model shows free cash flow of $12 million in year 3, ramping to $25 million by year 5. Its internal rate of return is 8%, comfortably above nothing, but 2 points below Orion's corporate WACC. NPV at 10% is negative $15 million. Jonah never mentions that figure. Speak, he directs attention to top-line pop. Nebula alone adds 6 points to Digital's growth rate. That takes Orion to the brink of Fortune's fastest 50 list. Board members smile at the publicity, and the growth-weighted bonus plan whispers in Jonah's ear. The vote passes 6-3. While division heads pitch, CFO Leila Ghosh works the phones with bankers. Orion's share price has languished in the high 20s for 18 months, and reported earnings per share sits at 1.40 on 100 million shares. The remuneration committee ties half the executive bonus pool to EPS growth. With interest rates still hospitable, Leila floats $500 million in seven-year notes at 5% and tenders for stock at a 10% premium. The resulting reduction in share count magnifies earnings per share despite the added interest burden. Fast forward 12 months. Energy prices spike, but Project Atlas delivers as promised. Cash flows match forecast, and Infracore posts EVA of plus $7 million. Carla's team shaves another $4 million off working capital. Her personal bonus accrues in a rolling bank, half payable only if EVA stays positive for two more years. Project Nebula, however, launches 6 weeks late. Monthly active users come in 18% below target. Promotional credits chew margins. Free cash flow is negative $6 million, not the positive $2 million Jonah had promised. The IRR drifts near 6%, and against a 10% cost of capital, year one EVA is minus $12 million. None of that touches Jonah's bonus calculation. Revenue still grew 21%. EBIT fell just short of plan, but stayed within the acceptable variance band. His cash bonus lands at 95% of target, and option gains dwarf it fivefold thanks to the buyback-powered EPS surge. What did shareholders get? Infracore's project added $40 million of value, digital eroded 15, so that net should be plus 25. But Orion bought back shares at a premium, effectively transferring $70 million to tendering stockholders. The economic sum sinks to minus $45 million, even though reported EPS soared by 21%, and the management incentive pool set a record. Late at night, by the lodge's fireplace, Leila shows the board a slide titled Two Divisions, One Mirror. It lists Infracore's $40 million gain, Digital's $15 million loss, and the $70 million overpayment for shares. A log pops in the flames as she explains, agency costs wore three different masks this year. One, a misset hurdle rate that greenlit a negative NPV digital project. Two, a growth-centric scorecard blind to economic profit. Three, an EPS-linked bonus that made a debt-funded buyback too attractive to refuse. She continues with proposed fixes. Digital's true hurdle is closer to 14%. Multi-year EVA, with limited capital charge holidays for R&D, would keep new ventures alive while maintaining accountability. A leverage collar would reduce temptation, cross 3.5 times EBITDA, and bonus multipliers fade. Finally, treat buybacks like any other project. Greenlight them only when the share price sits below a board-set intrinsic value band. A director asks how Carla feels about leveling the metric playing field. If digital clears 14%, pay them double mine, she replies. Just stop counting growth points that sink the ship. Jonah nods, subdued but intrigued. Give me 14% and 6 months. We'll kill the projects that can't clear it and double down on the ones that can. Orion's story is an X-ray that reveals every theme traced since our first boardroom dawn. Capital is never free. Discount rates need precision. Metrics magnetize behavior. Financing choices broadcast confidence or caution. Agency costs drift like silhouettes. Here in growth targets that hide negative NPV, there in buyback illusions, and everywhere in hurdle rates shaved for convenience. Yet the remedy is within reach. Anchor decisions to economic profit after a properly risked capital charge. Tailor discount rates, because a greenhouse is not a metaverse, and Infracore is not Nebula. Select metrics managers can directly influence, give them enough runway to prove long-term value, and install small buffers against sheer luck. Let capital structure serve the strategy, not the bonus checks, and apply EVA logic to share repurchases just as you would to a new product line. As dawn creeps over the Rockies, the board ratifies Layla's redesign. Treasury teams recalculate betas and HR reworks the scorecards, while Jonah drafts a list of digital experiments that fail to clear 14%. Carla heads to the airport knowing Atlas will no longer subsidize someone else's moonshot, and you, newly aware of how easily each lever can slip into misalignment, stand back from Orion's mirror with a final, integrated view. Agency theory set the stage. Economic value added put a price on alignment. Risk-true discount rates refined the lens. Carefully chosen scorecards guided behavior. And capital structure signals framed expectations. In isolation, each tool helps. Combined as a governance symphony, they bring clarity to the enterprise. Let them drift, and discord takes over. That is the journey. Boardroom to backbone, greenhouse to nebula, equity tap to buyback whirl, and its destination is simple enough to fit on a single sticky note. Capital has a cost, risk has a price, people follow the scoreboard. Design the game accordingly. Thank you for choosing Astory Publishing.